KSCO presents the Dr. and Mrs. Future program.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Happy Future Tuesday, everyone. Go ahead, getting exciting now. Power shutdowns tomorrow and the day after that.
Oh, boy, the future. I thought it was supposed to be looking bright. It's looking dim.
Well, we're off the grid. We've been off the grid for 14 years ourselves.
That's
up in Boulder
true.
Creek.
We were ready for these times of increasingly difficult grid systems.
And the big joke about it is it's not that difficult to be off the grid. The capacities for the solar panels are phenomenal these days.
Yeah. No, the universe favors those who are in harmony with nature. And when you're on grid power, you're very out of touch with natural cycles. We're very in touch with the weather. We're very in touch with what's happening with the solar panels and how much power it's generating. We know if a rainy day is coming because we have to get ready for that. If winds are in the air, we have to think about trees falling. We're still very integrated with nature, mostly because we haven't automated our lives out of it.
When you're out in the country, you're more aware of your environment. Mm-hmm. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And especially if you're off the grid, because we also have to do our own water.
Yeah.
And our
it's
own
true. We have different chores.
Yeah.
People don't think about chores when all you have to do is flip a switch.
Yeah. Well, what makes it a lot easier, you can put your attention on other things. Uh-huh. It's less survival oriented to live in town. No doubt
yes,
about it.
That's true. That's true. That's the benefit of having a nice central organization that takes care of complicated things like your technology and your power needs. And
so the main thing I would suggest, as having lived off the grid for 14 years now, is that you keep your devices charged. And what's nice about the phones, especially the light that's in your phone, is that they don't take much power.
Right.
And if you have one of those little recharger units, you can get at Costco or Best Buy or Amazon online for $30-$40. You can have a device that charges 4 or 5 times for your device, and it'll keep you going through the dark periods, if only for the use of the flashlight.
That's true. What do you need when the power goes out? You need light, especially at night.
Yeah.
You need communication.
Yeah, and there are a number of apps now that allow you to communicate with your friends without having to go through the cellular network.
Mm-hmm. You mean you can go through the internet instead?
Well, you can go through person-to-person networks. It's not so good when you're in the middle of nowhere, but if you're in town, if people belong to these various mesh networks, they'll connect cell phone to cell phone and create a local mesh network that doesn't require the internet.
Oh.
That's what we use.
Is this something we use?
We've used it at Symbiosis.
Oh, I see what you mean. Some of those apps that are literally
right.
meant to connect.
They're like walkie-talkie mm-hmm. apps. I'll put some links up on our webpage.
Right.
We're at drfutureshow.com/links. We'll have some stories for you to look along these lines.
Right.
The other thing is water. Make sure you have plenty of water. Might not be able to take a shower for a day or two. Mm. But that's probably the worst of it. Also, I'd keep a look on the weather patterns because PG&E is not going to turn stuff off unless we have winds. And if you look out there right now, there aren't any.
It would be good to know who's in charge of that switch, being able to turn it on or off. And
yeah.
really, they should be doing a podcast where they're looking at the weather report and explaining to people why they do what they do.
I just go to weather.com. I put in my zip code and look at the weather for the next 5 days. Look at the 5-day conference and see if the winds increase. Mm-hmm. That's one thing to do. Or maybe also do that for some other areas where they think there's going to be wind, like Sacramento mm-hmm. or Napa Valley.
So how do we find out where they think what's going on?
Well, they supposedly have a map. I just went to their planned shutoff fire threat map, and it's not showing me much. Maybe they'll update it today.
Okay.
And make it work, make it go. And it didn't work on a mobile device. It was only a laptop in which their interactive map worked. Uh-huh. They're a little woefully behind the times in giving you the data. But we'll keep an eye on it for you.
Well, the fact that they even have data like that that can be accessed through a public source, I would say, is very state-of-the-art. And, of course, we want everything to be live streaming, social media connectivity, et cetera. But come on, that's the cutting edge. There's a whole bunch of mainstreamers like us who are really glad that we can just look up the information, that it's somewhere.
Yeah, it's starting to get out there, you know, more and more so. From what I can see, there's a red zone around the mountains, of course. Boulder Creek, the San Lorenzo Valley is a red zone.
And that's red means high alert?
Higher alert, yeah. More so than the coast. The coastline and Santa Cruz proper is, according to this map, more of a white zone. There's a yellow zone along the coast that goes from Wilder Ranch all the way to Half Moon Bay and all the mountains. That's all yellow. Mm-hmm. But the San Lorenzo Valley is red, which means if this is accurate, that the red areas will be cut off first in the case of higher winds that may.
Does it look like there's a correlation between low population and high probability of power cutoff?
Well, in the mountains, there's less people, that's for sure. Yeah, there's more chance of a wildfire in San Lorenzo Valley than there is on Ocean Street in Santa Cruz.
Definitely.
You know, or Aptos.
Less eyes.
Except in the hills. Let's see, the red zone goes into the hills all the way down above Watsonville.
All right. Have you posted that link?
I'll do that during the break. Okay. I just found this one. It's an interactive map that actually gives you some real information about what they consider to be dangerous areas. As to how that corresponds to power shutoffs is to be determined. But we'll keep you posted as we get more information on this topic.
That's right. Live radio predicting power brownouts. Working with our national utilities and the public information.
And theoretically,
predict it.
KSCO should be on no matter what, even
That's
if it's
right.
a power fair, because we have these big generators that FEMA gave us that supposedly run.
We maintain.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see how well they work. Hopefully, we won't have to go there. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a possibility. The yellow zones also go into like a couple of towns along the coast, from San Mateo to Palo Alto.
Oh, boy. Quite a big spread.
Another red zone is on the other side of the bay, the Pleasanton area, down towards Walnut Creek along the 580 corridor. Also Marin, right over the bridge, Mill Valley, and up towards Point Reyes. Mount Tamalpais looks red.
Okay,
in the PG&E
great.
Map.
All right, folks, we're going to post those links on drfutureshow.com, which is brought to you by KSCO. Here's a break.
Okay, welcome back to the show, folks. Too much bass, Richard? I don't know if we have control over that. I mean, a lot of people go to have more bass in their mics.
It's built into your voice, honey.
Oh, okay. So it goes. Well, let's talk about Mars Curiosity. Is that better?
That's definitely better.
I see.
It might be in the speakers, you know.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Anyhow, what else? Well, talk about curiosities.
Yeah, we're going to cover some of our stories. We're also, if we get any more new news on the power outages, we'll certainly let you know. If you have any info for us, feel free to give us a call.
That's right. Listen and be heard. Just call us at 479-1080.
So I wanted to report that the Mars Curiosity rover has found evidence of an ancient oasis on Mars.
An oasis?
Yes.
Where
its
we
latest
see
trek.
Mirages kind of thing?
Yeah, that kind of thing. On its latest trek through the Gale Crater on Mars, the Curiosity rover has discovered evidence that's leading our scientists to believe that there was an oasis at the base of that 150-kilometer crater. 150
wide. A Martian oasis.
Yes.
Who'd have thunk?
Yes, it was published in Nature Geoscience earlier this week. Researchers analyzing data from the rover extrapolated data that showed enriched mineral salts there that suggests briny ponds that went through periods of drying out and overflowing.
Oh.
And drying out and overflowing.
Kind of like those ones that Bruce Damer says, the hot tubs where life started on planet Earth.
That's right. The hot tub rings.
Mm-hmm.
The hot tub rings is where life began. Well, Mars had similar circumstances. at least at Gale Crater. And these deposits created a watermark that suggests climate fluctuations. It's kind of like reading the rings in a tree.
Right.
When you're reading the bathtub rings of these craters. So the rover's been going up and looking at the different layers of the rings and analyzing it.
Right.
And the Gale Crater itself is a leftover geological formation from an impact that changed the basic surface of Mars itself. It's a huge...
One of those defining moments,
yes, 150 kilometer across crater.
Mm-hmm.
On Mars, the water and wind filled the crater and hardened the sediment, and then it was carved by wind, and it created what they call Mount Sharp, which is a geological formation that Curiosity is now scaling. It is taking samples of each layer as it climbs, and it's sending the data back to reveal more information about the environment on Mars.
Wow. Yeah. A very thorough investigation of the pond scum on Mars.
More information.
That has dried up and gone away. How old is it? That's what we want to know.
How old is it?
When did it disappear?
Yes. Well, the lead author of the project, William Rappin of Caltech, says, "We went to Gale Crater because it preserves this unique record of a changing Mars. Understanding when and how the planet's climate started evolving is a piece of another puzzle. When and how long was Mars capable of supporting microbial life at the surface?" See, that's what they're looking for now, is microbial life.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible? Which is very interesting, because we had on Late Night last night, Neil deGrasse Tyson, right?
Yes.
Because he pointed out that if it's not the same as life on Earth, if it was life there that evolved differently, if we actually ate it, which humans tend to do, eat things, we probably won't get any nutrition from it.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Okay.
So it could be different
Martian
enough that
fast food,
our body wouldn't know what to do with it.
It's not very satisfying. That's definitely a headliner.
Well, we'll see. Anyway, you got a caller, Ms. Future?
We do. We got a few people who wanted to respond to your invitation and talk about the power outage.
Yes, absolutely.
The living off the grid. And here we go.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to the show, David in San Francisco.
Hey, well, thank you. Up here in San Francisco, I work on energy issues.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I remember specifically about counterfeit parts that right after Fukushima happened, you remember they had left almost every other nuclear power plant online, and it took months, if not a year, to close down all of the power plants because they needed them. Their inspection process was kind of dubious. Tokyo Electric Power, that's TEPCO, that was the company that owned the Fukushima plant, and that was a blue chip of a blue chip stock.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like the super rich of the world owned TEPCO, and they basically ran it on the cheap. And so there were all of these other companies that, and I remember there was one in the southwest of Japan that got busted when they started inspecting the other plants. They really quickly shut them all down because they discovered that there were counterfeit parts.
Hmm.
And that the wholesaler or the suppliers, the purchasing agents, were basically buying defective parts. I remember specifically there were light switches that were supposed to be such high quality that, you know, if they were anywhere near the reactor core, you didn't want to send anybody in there to have to swap one out.
Really? So high, expensive fakes were made?
Yeah, exactly.
So just a little bit more graft and corruption in the industrial process there, huh?
Right. You know, so what I'm thinking of, and knowing that PG&E, when they blew up San Bruno, when they burned down Paradise, when they burned down Santa Rosa, they basically were frauding the safety system. When they blew up San Bruno, you know, natural gas is supposed to have a smell to it.
Mm-hmm.
Normally it has no smell.
They added to it, right?
Yeah.
They're supposed to, yeah. And in the case of San Bruno, they didn't add it because it was a dedicated line that was supposed to go to the power plant at Hunter's Point.
Oh.
And so there was no natural smell to it, or there was no smell to it because they were basically embezzling the money that they were supposed to use for the smell. In addition, it was found that the pipes there were pipes that they knew were defective, and they were put in the ground in 1954, and they pretended that they were inspecting them, but because they knew they were defective when they put them in, they couldn't stand to have them fail, so they were basically embezzling the money for the inspection and just always giving it a high rating.
Wow.
And so what I'm wondering is whether or not PG&E, I raised this at the PUC about a year ago, and that, you know, if PG&E can't be trusted, some years before they had embezzled $60 million in 1 year that they were supposed to use in tree branch eradication, and they just basically embezzled the money and didn't do the clipping, and they burned down part of Silicon Valley, some high-dollar neighborhood down in there.
So they're just a disaster waiting to happen, is what you're saying.
And what you're saying also is that money is a very poor arbiter of trust or accountability.
Well, right, and they basically embezzled the money. So what I'm worried about is that they've installed, whether it's even simple things, like when you've got the high-tension lines and you've got insulators, maybe those are defective. You remember 60 Minutes ran a piece about bolts that were used on airlines and that the defective parts were being used in airlines, and they were pulling the same scam. So as far as PG&E is concerned in the PUC, they're organized crime. There's just no other way of looking at it. Shutting down the San Onofre nuclear power plant is a recognition that these guys are not to be trusted with high-powered nuclear power plants, much less just running electricity across the Central Valley.
Has anyone actually determined what failed to cause the Camp Fire or the Paradise fires last year?
Well, as I understand it, it was also a matter of not cutting back branches, but it was also possibly that the insulators and the connectivity points, there were high winds up there, and that if they had used honest parts, they would have withstood the high winds. But whether or not, and this is speculation on my part, is whether or not they were using defective counterfeit parts and that the winds whipping around caused the outage.
Yeah, interesting. And I would imagine they had some kind of investigation ongoing on this.
Oh, yeah, there is. As a matter of fact, you can find that over at the PUC. They do their various hearings on PG&E, and you can watch them. You can see some of the discussion, and the word or the phrase organized crime does come up in that. The PUC does recognize them as very problematic because they time and time and time again, they embezzle the cleanup funds. They embezzle the tree trimming funds. What I was leading up to with the pipe at San Bruno, they knew it was defective from the beginning, 1954. They never inspected it, ever, because they knew it was defective, so they basically embezzled the money for something like 60 years.
Yeah, so do you think the grid is ultimately a money-losing proposition?
It is, of course, because if you know about electricity, you can't push it more than about, I don't know, is it something like 42 miles or something?
Oh, yeah, there's a tremendous efficiency drop-off. I think it's ridiculous, much less than 30% of the actual power that comes to the end of the line.
Yeah, exactly. That's why having solar panels all over town is going to be the smartest way to go, because when they start, it's not bad enough that they have to push this electricity. They basically are spending twice as much in order to get it. They burn twice as much coal nationwide as they have to because they waste so much electricity through the resistance in the wires, much less just the sloppiness of building the system. But the embezzling the funds and whether they used counterfeit parts, and then they now are recognizing that the counterfeit parts are so spread out that in a high wind situation they can't trust that they've swapped everything out.
Wow.
So that gets into
huge.
Public.
Crazy stuff. Yeah, I mean, it really, really makes you want to rethink the whole thing of how we get power.
Big conversation.
Yeah, well, thank you.
We're going to go to
appreciate
a break,
it.
David. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, stuff. All right. Dr. Future Show. We'll be right back after this. Well, there's definitely some kind of pendulum swinging away from central control, solving the power for the whole big society, back to putting things in the hands of smarter individuals, a little more local.
Yeah, I think decentralized power is becoming more and more practical. Mm-hmm. And we cover a number of stories along those lines, and we'll continue to do so. I have some on the lineup for this next half hour, as a matter of fact. But first, let's take some calls, shall we, Mrs. Future?
Sure.
What do we got?
Yes, we have Gary in Watsonville, who wants to respond to David in San Francisco, who we were talking to before the break.
Right.
Hi, Gary.
Hey, Gary.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, we're good.
You know, we have such an anti-corporation movement in this country. Profit is bad. And when I hear conspiracies or I hear stories like the fellow from San Francisco go on and on and on about fraud and covered every gamut of our utility system, which I don't know of anyone else who would replace PG&E, but when I hear all that, I never hear sources. I just hear it spewed out over the internet or the airwaves. It kind of disturbs me because...
Well, talk radio does do that. It does tend to combine people's hearsay with facts, and that can get confusing. I totally understand that.
But that's a good point to raise. And just for the record, I'm not anti-corporation or anti-profit, but I do think that the issues of accountability are suspect when there's such a gap between the people paying the money and the people receiving the money, and how do we hold people accountable?
Well, you know, that's a situation that has to be dealt with. But just to put out all this information without sources is, I think, almost along the lines of some of it may be misinformation. So that's all I kind of wanted to say.
Fair point. I do think that he did mention that events can be listened to online, that there are hearings with PG&E from
last year.
What's
going on with your mic?
Going in and out?
Yeah.
Well, maybe I should switch mics. That there are hearings online that you can listen to and hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak. And perhaps that's a good way to investigate this further.
Yeah, and Gary, I just want to say we're a call-in talk show. And we do the best we can to keep the conversation in a really nice, rational, intelligent format.
Issues like, is the grid really something that should be repaired, or should we begin to reimagine the grid? You know, that's the kind of stuff that we can look at. As to whether or not PG&E is being honest or not, I can't really tell you personally. But certainly people have their opinions about that, and we'll get them out there. But you're right, we don't know what's hearsay and what's truly real there.
In the words of Art Bell, this is a talk show. We're not a fact show so much as we are a conversational show.
Well, let's find out about it. How can you find out about fake parts? You know, that's an interesting thought. I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah. I mean, that was a very interesting subject to bring up.
Don't you think?
For me, it always goes to, I have this fantasy that the ideal way for people to be on top of the dangers of technology is to have a smaller group of people that are doing it and that are reporting to each other. I think when you get into something where one person is responsible for tens of thousands of people with their knowledge and expertise, there's not a good check for mistakes. Whereas if you have, say, one person who's accountable to, say, 500 people for their power, then people kind of know who it is, and they know what the strengths and weaknesses are of that person and in their circle. So I just think structurally it makes sense to put things into a more human scale, especially navigating things as complex as technology.
Good answer. Thank you very much.
Yeah, for the call, Gary.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay. We have Paul in San Francisco wants to talk about building a solar economy. Hi, Paul.
Yes, you are dealing with exactly the key word in your discussion you were just having. The key word is decentralization.
Yes.
If there's a way to decentralize the solar economy so that the corporations don't control it. And here's what is going on all over the world. Mm. It's not being reported in this country, but I am building a fourplex house with 100 solar panels on it in Paradise, California.
Oh, the rebuild of the town that burned down.
Yes. So this is one model I am building there just to show people how you can create more housing on the footprint where there's a single family house. You can actually build a fourplex house. California is now passing such a law right now as we speak that allows somebody who gets a single family house destroyed can rebuild it as a fourplex, add 100 solar panels, then require PG&E to pay 49 cents a kilowatt hour for the surplus solar they feed onto the grid, which lowers the cost of housing, helps pay the mortgage, and that way when there's a blackout, you still have power for your Tesla. So this is how we decentralize.
Would you still have a grid as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It works both ways. I'll tell you where this has been done for a long time. In Germany, I was in Germany during the meltdown at Chernobyl. The environmental movement went crazy saying we're going to stop nukes. This one guy had built a fourplex house out in the Black Forest, a guy named Hermann Scheer. He's actually one of the most famous philosophers in Germany, and his partner, Hans Joseph Fell. The two of them told the parliament there and said, let's require the utilities to pay solar homeowners 99 cents a kilowatt hour, and this will create a decentralized solar economy. We can shut down all the nukes in Germany and have Germany powered totally by wind and solar. And everybody said, you can't do that. And the parliament said, let's try it. So they did, and they started building these fourplex houses. If you ever want to see it in action, you go to Freiburg, Germany. They have about 10,000 of these fourplex houses with 100 solar panels each.
Is there any websites that cover this?
I doubt it. Just Google Freiburg, Germany, the University of Freiburg, and knows about this.
So I'm curious, Paul, in terms of what you're doing, are you doing something that is mandated, or are you doing something that's on your own initiative and you're trying to get other people to be aware of it and also do that?
I'm doing it on my own initiative. Mm-hmm. I'm an expert in this stuff, and so I was invited to Paradise to explain what we could do. And I spoke to a large group of people, and 25 families signed up with me to do this project. It's really a mess there. We still have massive asbestos cleanups going on in Paradise. Mm-hmm. There is destroyed houses everywhere. Many of the people I'm working with are in their 50s. They're not sure they want to rebuild. But we've got Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is representing these people up there, forcing the insurance companies to pay the money they owe, and trying to keep track of what. And I have filed an intervention motion lawsuit in the PG&E bankruptcy. So I have a seat at the table to say what we should do with PG&E. And what I'm pushing for is requiring PG&E to pay solar homeowners who feed onto the grid 49 cents a kilowatt hour. I'm not pushing for the 99 cents. That actually became the law in Germany. And I went to Germany and spent 6 weeks over there. And the farmers were laughing all the way to the bank because they put hundreds of solar panels on their homes and their barns, and they were making tons of money selling energy at 99 cents a kilowatt hour, and the utilities were forced to pay it. They fought it, but the parliament over there and the green movement was really strong, and they forced them to pay it. So the green movement in California is not as smart as the German green movement. So
this is a two-way grid in a way. It allows you to input from everyone as well.
Yes. There's one step more that you need to know about.
Yeah.
With the Tesla battery, you can actually do this now here in California. The way PG&E does it, they don't want you doing this right now. PG&E has total control. So you can get around them, though, by installing a Powerwall battery in your garage, and that way charge it when the electricity rates are low and then use it when they're high.
Right.
So you're saving money in the bank. And
that's what I was saying. What you need is that battery. That's the missing part, because the grid tie is one thing, but to be able to store the power and utilize it when you aren't getting power from the grid is another.
Right. But in Germany, they allow you to do it both ways.
Nice.
It's a policy thing, not a technological thing. If we can control the utilities, we can force them to do this. But right now, PG&E is in control. And so people have to stop doing fantasy things and try and do something serious. Like, most of my friends in the environmental movement want to just protest, and they want to ask the government to do something for them. And I just quote Kennedy saying, ask not what the government can do for you. You know, you got to do something.
Yeah, do it yourself.
You got to get a job as a carpenter.
Yeah.
You've got to start building these things.
Yeah, Paul, when you first started the call, you were talking about the idea that corporations have really usurped the power that we need to return to the people. And the model that I am imagining as the one that's really going to create the most stable infrastructure for the future is one where people in local communities form their own corporate structures with the expertise and knowledge that someone like you represents, which is how to put in a neighborhood scale solar power infrastructure so that everybody in the community can make money putting solar power in their own backyard. And that gives everybody an incentive to jump on board.
Yes, the microgrid. Mm-hmm. And the utilities are fighting us on this issue, but they can't win. Eventually, this is a battle the homeowners and the working class can win. Now, windmills are different. Windmills cost you $3 million, $4 million for a windmill.
We have to go to a break, Paul. Would you be willing to wait to carry on this conversation?
Sure.
Okay, great.
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, Dr. Future Show, anything else you want to say, honey?
No, we'll be right back. Okay, we have a caller on the line, Mrs. Future.
Right. Yes, we've been talking with Paul in San Francisco, who is very involved in creating a solar-powered
quadruplex. Quadruplex instead of a single-family dwelling in paradise. And I guess with four, you can have one for yourself, one for your in-laws, one for your kids,
right,
and one to rent out to pay for it all.
So I have a question for you, Paul, which is, what do you think is the primary impediment to the PG&E being the single source buyer for this distributed generation economy, and what can we do to get them on board?
Well, microgrid, and we're working in that direction. The community choice aggregation kind of thing may work. I'm not convinced, but you asked earlier if there's a site that is talking about this. Yeah,
yes.
I have a blog, if people want to look at it, where I put up all this information and videos from Germany when I was in Germany doing this work with the people there in Germany. And my name is Paul, and my website is Paul8, the figure 8, and then my last name is spelled K-A-N-G-A-S. My YouTube site is basically just YouTube. Paul 8 Kangas.
All right.
Okay, YouTube, Paul 8 Kangas. Okay.
All right, Paul. Well,
I put a video up, a fresh video up every day on this stuff.
Because Okay.
So much is happening so fast.
Yes.
Right now.
And the technology for doing it is getting more and more affordable all the time, too, wouldn't you say?
Yes. Yeah, and Germany is seriously the leading country in the world on this stuff.
Yeah. Right.
The German environmental movement did it.
That's what I understand, is that they went solar as opposed to France, which is almost all nuclear.
Yes, which is totally weird, the way Germany is now the greenest nation on Earth, and yet it doesn't get any credit for all this stuff. Oh, there's a book on it. It's called Energy Imperative by Hermann Scheer. He was the first one to do this in Germany in 1980. He built one of these fourplex houses with 100 solar panels.
All right. Listen, I just want to say I really appreciate all this information that you're sharing. And I know that we have a couple of things that we want to get out there. So we've got a few links connected to the fire and the upcoming weekend of rolling power outs that are planned for a lot of the communities here in our area. With that, I'd really appreciate if you just gave people a link to follow up with more information. And then
your YouTube, right? Here's your YouTube link.
Yeah, my YouTube, because I put a video, whatever's going on today, is going to be up on my YouTube tomorrow. So
okay, so you give that YouTube link again?
Sure, it's Paul8, the figure 8, Kangas, K-A-N-G-A-S. And I have several million hits. I've got several thousand videos up.
Wow.
A lot of them from paradise and from Germany and wherever else I find the solar information.
Gotcha.
My
main
focus.
Okay.
Thanks for being such a great resource, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Really
appreciate it.
Thanks for calling the show.
Okay.
Thank you to the future.
You're welcome. How did you hear about our show, by the way?
Oh, how did I hear about you? A friend of mine listens online, and he called me up and he said, these people are talking about the future, and you're really into the future
stuff.
Oh,
okay. Maybe Bobby, maybe?
Great.
Why don't you give them a call and put a few good words about the future in? Because that's what I feel I'm doing, is building the future. Yeah. I have lived in Germany. I have lived in the future, and it works.
Nice.
Perfect. Well, thank you. That's perfect for our show. Thank you.
Happy to meet a kindred spirit. Yeah. Thanks for sharing the load.
We'll put your link up on our page.
Okay, Paul. 8, Kangas. Appreciate your call.
Okay.
Okay, bye for now.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Well, you know, another interesting evolution is the way in which we're dealing with fires once they happen. There's a very interesting story about a new substance. Like, I saw this on Science Alert. Called an engineer creates a sprayable gel that acts like a vaccine for wildfires.
Amazing.
Yeah. Getting that in a moment.
We have another interesting commentator, another great sage from our radio station, Michael Wilson.
I have two things to say.
Yes.
One, happy birthday, Dr. Future. Dr. Future, happy birthday.
Thank you.
It's good to have a birthday this time of year because then you can do a lot of it outside and everything is perfect.
That's right. Okay. Indian summer goes all the way into October these days.
I must say, I enjoy the weather this year.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to offer a brief comment was on that decentralization of the power infrastructure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm a think local first kind of guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think with respect to the deliverance of our electricity, it's a very good thing that we have a very extended grid supported by a lot of other people who do not live in Santa Cruz County. Because when it comes to delivering electricity in adverse weather conditions, Santa Cruz County is a disaster area.
Mm-hmm.
If it weren't for people in Fresno buying electricity from PG&E, if we had to foot the entire bill for our electrical grid here in the county, we'd go broke.
Really? It's that
Well, that's an interesting point, but maybe there's a win-win where what we talk about is locally people having small businesses making their own power, but we create a connectivity to a central grid. I mean,
the microgrid concept is a
feeder network.
Yeah, we have to have that grid. Mm-hmm. And that grid is supported by people throughout Northern California.
Mm-hmm. But what about the graft? What about all of the money that is collected by people who aren't really using it for what they're collecting
for? Well, I agree with you. The bigger things get, the more corrupt they become. Lord, what's his name said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the bigger you get, the more corrupt you become. Mm-hmm. Just saying, though, a couple years ago, I went for a ride on a trouble man, PG&E trouble man, in a big storm up in Boulder Creek. Without him and all of the people they brought in from all over PG&E's service area, we'd have been toast. Now, think of the cost involved in maintaining power in storms when all of those branches are falling on the trees.
That's when it costs the most.
That's when it costs huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm just saying that without the support of people in Fresno, that grid that we have that goes through the trees would be awesomely expensive.
Maybe what we need is better accounting. Maybe somehow we just need to really be aware of how the money could be used more efficiently, because that seems to be the problem.
Another alternative is when you find somebody that's corrupt, take them to the edge of town and
show a sayonara.
Ooh, Dems fighting words. All right, thanks,
all right,
Michael.
Well, that's a good point, Michael. The grid is a very expensive proposition, and it needs massive numbers of people to feed into it to make it cost effective.
Yeah. Well, you can't legislate stupidity. You can't legislate conscientiousness.
However,
you have to do is come up with people who care about each other and get them to work together to solve problems.
But I do like the idea of the Tesla wall.
Yeah, you know, that was cool. I like that.
The other thing is, if you have solar panels and you're just feeding the grid, that's one thing. But if the grid does go down, you don't get any power because you're not...
that's right. It's not designed. All or nothing.
But if you have a battery to save some of your power locally, then you can utilize that locally.
Very nice.
Which is kind of neat. So I think you need both. You need the decentralized and the centralized systems working effectively with each other.
That's right.
I guess Germany is a good example of how that...
Well, I think it's about creating the incentives so that people are getting self-interest. They're getting rewards from doing the right thing.
Yeah. So on the other side of things, once there is a wildfire, what do we do? Right now we have a very efficient, very good system for our area for dealing with this, with airplane spotters and firefighters on the ground and in the air dealing with it. But Cal Fire is testing out a new gel-like fluid that sticks to vegetation for months on end, and it could be an ingenious way to stop Mother Nature from burning.
I love this solution.
It was devised by an engineer and a former fire prevention forester. It's a sprayable retardant that could be used to drastically reduce forest fires. So what you do is, instead of doing a fire break, you would coat vast areas of vegetation with this substance, and it would stop the fire.
Right.
From going there. It has the potential of making wildland firefighting more proactive rather than reactive.
Sure, because they could spray the vegetation on the side of the roads and make it fireproof.
Yes, this is engineer Eric Apple from Stanford University. He's a material scientist there. He says, what we do now is monitor wildfire-prone areas and wait with bated breath for fires to start, then rush out to put them out. When firefighters respond at the site of active fires, they use retardants like salt, ammonium, polyphosphate, or APP, which creates water when it's burned. The problem is that those solutions only work in the short term. They lose their effectiveness once the water evaporates, and that can happen in under an hour easily. Mm-hmm. So this new gel is sticky and fire-resilient and...
Non-toxic.
Non-toxic, right. Made primarily from plant materials.
Right.
Cellulose-based, so it dissolves after a time.
Wow.
To be continued, we'll talk more about these things. Also, we have a guest in the second hour.
Yes, we're going to give Louis Schwartzberg a call.